You're listening to A Week in Wireless by Telecoms.com, the podcast dedicated to everything and anything going on in the telecoms biz. On this week's A Week in Wireless, Euro 2016 fever sees EE reach record data traffic. VR, virtual reality, actual reality, or just virtual insanity? Clouded thinking, is cloud computing the next great illusion? We'll have a bit more M&A madness, and we'll also be discussing Brexit and, as usual, our quirk of the week. Do you want to join the argument? Tweet us at Telecoms. Hello and welcome to A Week in Wireless, the podcast brought to you by Telecoms.com, covering everything and anything in the telecoms biz. My name is Tim Skinner and joining me today is Jamie Davies.
Hi there, Tim.
And we've also got Scott Biceno in the room. How you doing, Scott?
Hello, I'm great, thanks.
Lovely. Okay, right, let's get down to business, shall we? The first thing on our agenda today is a bit of Euro 2016 fever, keeping it current with everything that's going on at the moment. So yesterday, we saw England versus Wales. I think there are a few sore heads this morning. But EE says, Scott, I'll start with you as you wrote this today, EE says that it set a new mobile data record. How about that?
Yeah, well, it was like 50% higher than the last spike they had. So EE's the UK network, and they measure traffic on their own, mobile data traffic on their own network. The last spike was football related, and funnily enough, it wasn't England football. It was an Australian, Tim Cahill, hitting a pretty nice volley against Netherlands in World Cup 2014. Mm. But this time, the peak around the time, certainly towards the end of the second half of the game, was 50% higher even than that. And the point seems to be, and I can certainly attest to this myself, went to the pub to watch it. And it was a pretty packed pub, and I couldn't be bothered to sort of jostle and elbow my way. So I went and found a quiet corner of the pub and just watched it on my phone while everyone else was watching. So I was one of the people, and I'm on EE, so I was one of the people that contributed to that data.
Oh, you should be proud.
I am.
You should be proud. And yeah, speaking of the Beeb, they also mentioned a couple of stats about the game. They said that it was a peak for them, and their iPlayer service said that it had 2.3 million live streamers during the game. It's quite an amount, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And 15 million, almost 15 million unique browser sessions during the game as well. So, yeah, big deal. And what does that say to you then, Scott or Jamie, whoever wants to chime in here, about sort of peak events and how operators sort of have to manage this sudden surge in traffic?
Well, I'll start off, and then I want to hand it to Jamie because he's also Welsh, and I want to get his perspective on the game. Another stat I got from EE today was with regards to a story I'd written previously about Wembley, which they're a sponsor of, and they track mobile data use specifically within Wembley Stadium while there are major events like cup semi-finals and finals. Mm-hmm. And this year's FA Cup final had almost double the amount of mobile traffic on the previous year, which in itself was double the previous year. So it's sort of doubling every year, the amount of mobile data people use. And they say it's the same old thing. It's a mixture of streaming highlights. So there's a slightly surreal thing of being at the game, but still streaming highlights on your phone.
Yeah.
But you can imagine why, especially if you're up in the bleachers and you can't really see what's going on. And then the other one's just people obviously sharing to social media, some picture of a tiny little speck kicking a ball about. You like to stick that on Facebook.
And then
I don't know, just checking, perhaps checking sort of the word on the street on the game. So there was probably a fair bit of that. And yeah, so handing it over to you, Jamie, a bit of a poison chalice, as of course England did beat Wales. But I imagine for a while, certainly in the first half, the sort of pro Wales chatter was quite high. How are you feeling over the course of the match?
It's I don't know, it's an interesting game, and I think it's a very interesting point you've brought up there. A couple of weeks ago, as I've rounded the Accenture offices, and they were talking mainly about the idea that, and I don't know whether this is a good or a bad thing, that everyone's attention span is just so low now. The idea of being engaged by what's on the TV, or if you're at the stadium, what's on the pitch, just isn't enough for anyone. And I think that links back quite well to the stats that you brought up about the BBC. Mm-hmm. Accenture, they were one of the technology partners of the Six Nations, and part of what they realised was that everyone wants to be engaged on Facebook and checking other websites, running apps on their iPad or on their phone while they're watching the TV. So part of what they're trying to do is make sure that if you're watching the football, you've also got the the BBC football app in front of you, so you're actually capturing that audience as well. And I don't, like I said, I don't know whether it's a good thing or a bad thing that we can't be engaged by one thing at any one point. Yeah. But
it's reality now, isn't it?
It's just reality.
Yeah, I recall the days before we started streaming things, where if you were in the nosebleed seats, so to speak, at these big sort of events in stadia, I remember using my phone as a zoomer, so I could see a bit more action, see the band on stage or the ball moving around. I suppose that's a natural evolution from people using binoculars.
Well, there we go.
So let's move on. Enough about football. We're here to talk about telecoms, guys. Mm-hmm. And let's start off with a piece that we have called, at least that I've provisionally titled, VR, Virtual Reality, Actual Reality, or just Virtual Insanity. It seems recently that buzz around VR has really kicked up a notch. We've seen a lot of devices being released. We've seen a lot of applications. E3 was just full of VR stuff this year, as was Mobile World Congress. You and I managed to get our grubby mitts on a pair of VR
Samsung
headsets.
Event.
So VR taking off after, let's say, sort of 30 years of its potential being around in the market. Is that for better or for worse, or is it going to be another, let's call it 3D TV?
Well, I can't see that it's going to be as big as everyone is making it out to be at the moment. I mean, I don't think it'll go down the same way as the 3D TV. I think there's definite applications when you look at maybe high-end gaming back at home, or you've got the Top Golf bars in central London. I mean, why can't you have sort of like virtual reality bars or estate agents where you... But ultimately, I think it'll be big. I don't think it'll be as big as everyone is making out to be.
Well, I'll turn to you on this one, Scott, then. We talked about this a little bit last week, as that kind of just constant hype cycle that keeps going around with these technologies. Where do you think we are with VR? Do you think that we're approaching some sort of maturity here?
I think the hype cycle got a spike at Mobile World Congress, specifically because of the event we attended. Samsung was going big on it. It gave a Samsung VR... it's not even really a headset, it's an accessory, and you plug your Samsung phone into it.
Yes.
And then Mark Zuckerberg, the CEO of Facebook, turned up, and he, of course, his company bought a VR company called Oculus not too long ago, so he's obviously got a strategic interest in it. And Zuckerberg was saying, you know, he can imagine social, which is obviously what Facebook's all about, being augmented by VR. And I guess this goes for sort of conferencing and all that sort of thing. We plug in our headsets and we actually feel like we're in front of each other.
Mm.
But we've had teleconferencing for a while, all that sort of thing. I'm not sure how bothered people are about that. There's still, I don't think there's going to be any substitute for being in front of a person, however much you try and sort of virtualize it. So there's that. So yes, the hype cycle's picked up. From a telecoms point of view, it's interesting because of the potential strain on the network. If people are walking around with wireless headsets on that are having to derive the data they get from the cloud... Then that's going to have to go through mobile networks, and that's going to be very data intensive. It's going to make all this stuff we were just talking about with the football games pale into insignificance.
That's a very good point, actually, because I saw a stat from ZTE. They claimed a VR sort of successful content streaming win, I suppose. But they said VR... to get a true VR streaming experience, you're going to need 60 megabits per second download speeds and a sub 20 millisecond latency. So that leads me on to think, are we only going to really get really good VR with 5G?
Yeah, I think you're probably right. And this is one of these things, one of these use cases, together with things like IoT and various other buzzwords that people are going to associate with 5G and hopefully be a driver. Because another thing to not forget about things like 5G, any new generation of mobile technology, is it requires a ton of investment. And people are looking for a payoff on that investment. So I remember, you know, when 3G came along and there were these massive auctions and all the telecoms companies, all the operators spent tons of money on these licenses. And they were going, yeah, but it's fine, we'll make it back because everyone will be paying top dollar to stream sort of premium video and that sort of thing. And they didn't. So that's the other worry for these operators, is they invest in this next generation, but then the reason for people to upgrade to it and pay a premium for it isn't there.
Mm.
So maybe they're hoping VR will be one of those reasons.
Quite, yes. And I think just moving on to another element of VR is the content side of things. Scott, you and I were at a Reuters discussion a couple of weeks ago about the future of digital content, specifically publishing, but we spoke at length about VR content. And there's a lot of content coming out at the moment on VR. You know, Guardian had their project, and if anybody hasn't seen this yet, it's called 6x9, and it's meant to be a virtual reality simulation of a solitary confinement experience. Mm-hmm. And aside from the kind of ethics or moral boundaries, how far do you go with recreating what is meant to be an incredibly torturous process?
Which I think is the point of it. This is how terrible it is.
Well, yeah, exactly. But even the Guardian head of the project said we had to make sure we didn't need to have people going to therapy afterwards because they've been through such a traumatic experience. So obviously you don't want to make it that real. But then at E3, Jamie, you wrote a piece earlier this week about some of the games coming out at E3. So we saw Facebook and Sony made for VR content, as well as Bethesda Softworks, and they're responsible for video game licenses and titles such as Fallout, Doom, and Quake. So, you know, apart from the terrifying game element that could present, what do you think about some of the sort of gaming opportunities that come around with VR? And also, just to go on from that, do you think there's a place for telcos to be providing that?
Well, I think there's definitely an opportunity for it. I mean, first and foremost, it's too expensive. I mean, you're never going to get through the sort of the mass adoption rates when it's, I think it's $499 for a headset
plus
at the moment.
Yeah.
That's the cheapest one that's around at the moment. I mean, you're never going to get the cut through to the mainstream audience if it's that expensive. But then at the same time, you look at what gaming is at the moment, and this ties back to what you were saying, Scott, about the stress on the network. Gaming has gone on so much from your on your own playing the computer in your study. You know, it's all about online gaming now, and can it be done? You know, I think that's the real issue at the moment, is that the stress that we saw for smartphone adoption when that hit the mainstream, you know, is that going to be the same stress, and are these data intensive games going to actually be able to live up to consumer expectations when we're actually in this online mode?
Yeah, that's a very good point. And personally, I've got a real bugbear with VR. I'm sure I'll be proven wrong, but I don't like it. I've experienced it, made me feel nauseous. It's something that I don't particularly fancy, you know, doing at my own leisure. But I'm sure there's a massive market for it, and you know, there are plenty of other use cases emerging, and it's probably going to be something that does stick around for a while based on some of the things that we've been talking about. And yeah, so any concluding thoughts on VR before we move on?
Well, just one last thought. VR, and to some extent AR, augmented reality, which, just to recap, is looking basically looking through your smartphone camera and screen and superimposing digital information on real life. The limiting factor I think both of them have is that it requires you to stare at a screen. Mm. Yeah, VR is more immersive and you've got to actually strap it to your face, whereas AR, you've just got to hold your phone up. But either way, it's kind of an exclusive thing. You can't do other stuff at the same time.
Yeah.
So it's immersive, it's all-encompassing, and I think that's a limiting factor. It's a point in its favour because, you know, VR is a kind of a level of experience that you don't get otherwise, but the flip side is you can't be trying to do anything else.
Well, yes, and speaking of immersive, this is one of the things that I can't quite get about VR, is this kind of sensory disconnect. When you experience something in reality, there's a whole bunch of different processes that are happening in your body to make you experience something. It's sensory in terms of your sights, your hearing, your smell, your balance, you know, all that sort of stuff. And VR, to a certain extent, is only reproducing one of those. It's producing the visual element and maybe the audio element as well. But then I think maybe this is why I experience motion sickness, is because of this disconnect between what you're seeing and how your body is being affected by it. And I just think that's a big hurdle that they're going to have to try and overcome without having to release a plethora of multiple additional additional devices to help recreate this whole experience.
Agreed.
Well, that's one to watch. So let's move on, shall we? Next part is about cloud. We touched upon cloud just a moment ago as an enabler of VR content. But Jamie, you ran an interview this week where Raj Samani, the CTO of Intel Security, is that right?
That's right, yeah, yes.
That's right.
Yeah.
He had an interesting perspective to describe cloud. So why don't you enlighten us?
Well, I mean, his perspective more than anything else, and I think this is one of the big issues with the cloud, not only from the business side of things, but also the consumer, is that very few people actually understand it. You know, if you ask anyone on the street, have they heard of the cloud, they'll always say yes. If you ask them to define what the cloud actually is, then it becomes a bit tricky. And I think Raj put it down as, you know, just in very simple terms, it's someone else's computer. It's someone else selling services through the internet. And I think that's what one of the big issues with cloud security and adoption and interoperability at the moment is this idea of perception versus reality. Everyone's got this perception of the cloud, but the reality is very different. I think one of the interesting points that Raj was talking about is a survey that Intel ran a couple of weeks ago, and they were talking about what is the big challenge of cloud computing. Now, prior to people actually adopting the cloud, they always said security. Security is going to be the big issue.
Yep.
But once they've actually adopted it, the reality is that interoperability is the big challenge. And that is, for Raj, the big challenge with security is that everyone thinks too much of it. But if you take, you know, cloud computing as outsourcing, which is essentially what it is,
yep.
you're outsourcing your computer to someone else. You put the same assurance on cloud computing for security as you do with every other aspect of outsourcing the business.
Yep.
And then security doesn't become a challenge anymore. Well, obviously, it still becomes a challenge, but it's about guarding yourself.
Mm.
And it's that perception versus reality, in that you understand there's risk, but you're not outsourcing the risk, you're just minimizing it as much as possible. Then you start to minimize the security impacts of cloud computing.
Mm.
I think one of the points Raj made sort of quite clear and was actually a really good point is the idea that you can't outsource security risk. I don't think TalkTalk really understood that. They tried to outsource cloud computing, but then probably didn't put the necessary safeguards in before it. When their breach came along, they lost 100,000 customers.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, that it's the risk appetite and putting the assurance in prior to actually sort of outsourcing your compute power is where a lot of people will see some big benefits.
And there's going to be risk if you stay 100% on premise, obviously.
Mm. Yeah.
So there's pros and cons. One of the ways in which I sort of think about the cloud is try and think of consumer cloud rather than B2B cloud. So take a classic one for me is music.
Yeah.
So consumer cloud for music is Spotify and other streaming services, but Spotify is the market leader. And on-premise is having a shelf full of CDs, as far as I'm concerned. And when I buy music now, you know, so there's real advantages to buying it in the cloud. So if I buy something, an MP3 off Amazon, I can immediately sync it with my phone and I can listen to it on my way to work. But I've got that slight, I think it's a control thing, I've got that slight worry that Amazon is in control of my music collection and one day some arbitrary Amazon-y thing could happen where that gets taken away. So what I do is I buy from Amazon, I buy CDs that have this thing called auto-rip.
Mm.
So you're basically buying the digital file and the CD at the same time. You get the digital file straight away, and the CD turns up in the post a week or two later. And so what I'm doing there, basically, I suppose you could say, Jamie, it's a hybrid cloud.
Yeah. Similar proposition.
So that's how I hedge my risk.
I think the point that you made about the ownership of content and sort of keeping it secure, I suppose, that extends also to Facebook with the photos. And I know there's been talk this week about having to subscribe to a specific new service by Facebook in order to make sure that you don't lose
your cloud
possibly
stored photos.
Over a decade's worth of photos that some people have on Facebook now. And, you know, where does it stop? Do you subscribe to a new service at first and then you have to pay £1 a month or £1 a year or whatever it becomes? Yeah, there is that sort of hesitancy over, I suppose, just leaving it all to a third
party. Well, any subscription service, you know, I think, I can't think of specific names, but there's some subscription services that are all really great until you stop subscribing, and then all the stuff that you had before disappears. In other words, you've got to keep subscribing to keep your sort of library. And so there I feel, as a consumer, I've lost a lot of control. And the vendor has a lot of control of that dynamic, which makes me a bit uneasy as well.
Yeah. I think. Sorry, Jamie.
Oh, well, I think that was sort of part of the points that we were sort of discussing last week as well. It's about defining the sort of the risk associated with each individual workload or each set of data that you put onto the cloud. Mm. You know, the higher risk ones, you pay more. And you put it in a more secure cloud proposition. Mm-hmm. And the lower risk ones, where you're not that bothered, it's not really that dangerous, you put them in the less secure cloud options. And that sort of like dynamic pricing and you know, redefining risk and moving it between cloud providers is where, firstly, the cloud becomes a lot more cost effective. And then secondly, you become more secure. Mm-hmm. But I think understanding what the risk is where the big issue. And I think, like you said, with your sort of music sort of problem there. I mean, how much of an issue is it if you lose your music? I mean, should it be more? Should you be paying more for it to be more secure? Mm. Should you be paying less?
And each person gets to determine, you know, how they price their risk. But as long as I've got a shelf full of CDs, then I feel the risk is managed.
Okay, great. Let's move on from that one. We're going to take a very quick break. We'll be right back just after this.
The Global Telecoms Awards 2016 are now open for entry submissions, welcoming everyone from every part of the telecoms industry. Has your company achieved something great this year? Submit an entry and gain international recognition for your achievements. 22 categories cover almost everything in the telecoms industry, and the big winners will be announced at Black Tie Gala Dinner on the bank of the River Thames in London on the 2nd of November. To find out more and to submit your entry for the Global Telecoms Awards 2016, go to telecoms.com/awards.
Okay, welcome back. Thanks very much for sticking with us. You're listening to A Week in Wireless, the telecoms.com podcast. And just before the break, we were talking quite a lot about cloud computing. And there's been quite a lot of cloud sort of consolidation activity this week. M&A's ongoing. Last week, we spoke quite a bit about telcos. But this week has been a very vendor-centric sort of M&A week, I suppose. We started off the week with the Microsoft acquisition of LinkedIn, a whopping $26 billion. Acquisition for Microsoft. So who wants to chime in with a little bit of thought about Microsoft?
Well, I will chime in as we touched on it actually in the last podcast. It was breaking as we were recording the last podcast, and so we've had a bit of time to digest that since then, and we've chatted about it amongst ourselves, and we do think it's quite a cloudy bit of M&A because while Microsoft does a lot in the cloud and it's got its Azure platform and obviously things like Office has moved to a more as a service model with Office 365 and all that sort of thing, I think it imagines that LinkedIn, which is, you know, basically one of the possibly the second biggest social network in the world behind Facebook and is specifically a business social network. Microsoft thinks that fits quite well with things like Office 365 and some of its other cloudy stuff, because you know maybe you could combine professional social activity with other forms of collaboration, like where you'd previously use SharePoint or something like that, or who knows what else. And obviously, you know, LinkedIn's also got millions of members, all of whom are quite demographically detailed by their job function, and you know, you basically got everyone's CV.
Oh, there's a huge amount of personal details.
So the amount of data on a lot of probably quite high net worth individuals that they've just bought there is quite handy. That looks like a pretty cloudy move to me. What do you reckon, Jamie?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things, because we've been looking into this quite a lot over the last couple of days, and one of the questions that's really come up in my head, and I haven't got an answer for this yet, is what is the role of social media in the workplace? I can't really see why social media will make the the workplace a better place as opposed to a chattier place.
Beyond the marketing and the brand awareness kind of things, yeah.
But I mean, one of the interesting points that I sort of look at this acquisition and where it ties in is the role of Microsoft in sort of enterprise IT. Because there was a survey from JP Morgan, it's probably about 2 or 3 months ago. They were talking to various CIOs about the role of vendors and the importance of certain vendors in their organization. And Microsoft was by far and away the most important vendor to, I think it was something like 45, 46% of the CEOs in the survey. And it was mainly because they do everything. Mm-hmm. They're more important than AWS because AWS just does the cloud. They touch in every single part of the business. Mm. And I think bringing in that social element to the vendor proposition, the Microsoft proposition, starts to complete the circle. They're becoming more and more valuable to CIOs. They're touching more and more parts of the business. So if a CIO does want to leave, it becomes so much more difficult when the entire business is ingrained with Microsoft.
Mm-hmm. Next acquisition then, we saw Samsung making a bit of an IoT move. They picked up a company called Joyent, I think it's called, but it's undisclosed fee, so presumably not in the same ballpark as the eye-boggling sums we saw with Microsoft forking out on LinkedIn. But this adds to Samsung also buying an ecosystem startup for IoT called SmartThings a couple of years ago now. So, Scott, tell me your thoughts on Samsung as an IoT player.
Yeah, I mean, this is as much... You know, these terms all get a bit interdependent, but this is as much a cloud play as is an IoT play. But, you know, that's not mutually exclusive because IoT is completely dependent on the cloud. I mean, the whole model for IoT is that you've got a bunch of sensors in the field generating a ton of data, and then they transfer that data into the cloud where it gets processed and decisions made, and then those decisions get sent back to these little IoT devices, and they all scurry about doing smart things. Mm. That's the theory, anyway. And of course, we can all see some kind of Terminator-like when they all become self-aware and start taking over. But let's not worry about that.
I think I'd rather become a hermit.
And Joyent is a cloud provider. So this is an IoT play in so much as the interdependence between IoT and the cloud, but it's also a consumer cloud play, we reckon. Because Samsung, a big challenge Samsung and any Android vendor's got is differentiation. What's the difference between my HTC phone and someone else's Samsung phone? No, you two aren't much help because you've got an iPhone and Jamie's just got a rubbish phone.
He just doesn't have a phone.
but let's imagine you had a Samsung phone and let's say a Sony phone. What would be the difference? They'd all be black rectangles with the same operating system on them.
Yeah.
And roughly the same hardware spec. So Samsung, which is the market leader in Android, is investing a lot of R&D in trying to come up with unique Samsung-y things to make, you know, to differentiate its phones more. Mm. And so having its own cloud infrastructure means it can have its own services and, you know, they can do their own Samsung version of LinkedIn or something if they wanted, whatever. I'm not saying it will take off, but they're welcome to give it a try. And it just makes them a little bit more autonomous and a little bit more able to innovate in the software and services, which is about the only area left to Android vendors to innovate.
Yeah. It's not even necessarily just about the smartphone side of things, though. You know, Samsung's got a very broad consumer electronics range in general.
Yeah, very true.
And that's going to be a big part of it, I'm sure.
Yeah, so they've got a potential to be a massive IoT player because they do all these other consumer electronics, definitely.
Yeah. Okay, there have been a couple of other M&As along the way, but nothing that I think we really need to go into detail. So let's move on then to the final sort of segment of today's show. Let's say penultimate segment of today's show, which is about Brexit, which is going to be a very topical discussion. And depending on when you're listening to this show, ladies and gentlemen, it could either have already been decided that we're still part of the EU. It could be decided that we're not part of the EU. So let's hedge our bets here.
Yeah.
So article that you wrote this week, Scott, says opinion divided on the effect of Brexit on telecoms. So, in this report, can you just summarise what's going on here? Yep. Will consumers benefit? Will operators benefit? Will both benefit? Will neither benefit?
Right. So, simple answer is no one knows.
Cool.
And this article
moving on.
Yeah, and this article was while it was obviously because we write telecoms.com, it was telecoms focused, but it is also a microcosm of the broader debate, which is it's so complicated. There's so many rules and regulations and interdependencies and variables that it's pretty much impossible, even if you're using like a crazy supercomputer, to accurately model how it's all going to play out. You know, it has yielded a lot of interesting discussion, certainly in our office, and I suspect other offices.
Sure.
I personally find the whole thing a lot more interesting than, let's say, a general election, where you're normally choosing between the same usual sort of type of person. This is an actual once-in-a-generation significant decision.
Yeah.
I think most people find it democratically quite exciting.
I think it's interesting to see sort of infighting within parties as well. It's brilliant.
Yeah.
All the mudslinging is awesome.
Definitely. And both the main parties are split on this one. And, you know, as has also been noted, as we get closer, the public discourse gets more hysterical.
Sure.
And people are likely to, you know, back to the central point, that the story I was talking about, how it's impossible to project. That's not stopping people having a guess.
No, of course.
And going, well,
someone has to make a living, don't they?
Fire and brimstone is going to fall from the sky if you go one direction or the other. So, you know, that's interesting as well. And, you know, whichever way the vote goes on the 23rd, I think there's going to be a few sort of emotional scars that take a while to heal.
Yeah.
It was a telecoms angle, but I've got to be quite honest, I wrote it just because I find the broader subject interesting. And I just happened to see some stuff from people like the Economist's Intelligence Unit that gave me a sufficient justification to write about Brexit in a telecoms context.
Fair enough. Well, one of the points that does kind of come up, I suppose, when we're talking about Brexit is roaming or broaming. So, Jay, Europe has set max roaming charges for June 2017. Why don't you go into a bit of detail about that? Because I know they've been working on this for quite a long time. It's a long-term project. It seems to be coming to some sort of fruition now. What's going on?
Yeah, so, I mean, well, yeah, to say it's a long-term project, I think that's nice.
I think understatement.
It was first brought up in, 2005, 2006, about the unfair charges and how much the consumer is actually paying. But by the looks of it, we can see the end of the road. There has been a middle ground charge, you know, limiting the operators for, I think, about 12 months now. And now that the charges for fair, to make it fairer for the consumer, essentially, have been set, roaming and is ultimately going to end, I think, in June 2017.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we've got a year.
Assuming everything goes smoothly. Yeah. The European Commission say they're on track. Mm-hmm. If you take the word for it, I can't see any reason why something will go wrong.
And the Brexit angle is, if we leave Europe, do our operators then suddenly go crazy and start charging us tons for roaming again?
I'm of the opinion that I don't think they'll be allowed to. Still, they're not. I don't think Ofcom will permit it. I think, you know, if operators in England are no longer then bound to the European Commission, which I suppose intracontinental, should I say, operators probably still would be, even then Ofcom are still going to be saying, well, hold your horses, just because we're not in the EU anymore doesn't mean you can start rinsing your consumers for all it's worth.
And the other point is, you know, people have been quite black and white about this Brexit, like if we leave Europe, you know, no one's going to be allowed to eat Italian food anymore or something like that. And it's really not as simple as that. We're still geographically part of Europe. We're still going to be trading with them. And we're still going to have lots of treaties on things like technology sort of standardisation or rules. Mm. And there's no reason why, even if we leave, we can't opt to sign up to some of this stuff.
Yeah.
I think, you know, the people arguing to leave are saying we'd like to be able to choose rather than be forced to do everything.
Yeah. Brinteresting. Should I stop?
Yes, okay. Please.
Okay. Right, final part of the week then, guys. It's our quirk of the week. We always keep an eye out for some of the funnier, lighter hearted things that we see in telecoms, and one of the things making the round this week was is emojis. People have been getting all excited again about emojis. Apple is going to be pimping out its iMessage service. Mm-hmm. Let's say pimping up instead of pimping out, shall we? Where, you know, emojis are bigger and better and more emoji than ever. Mm-hmm. And yeah, and then and Twitter, actually quite interestingly, is going to be using sort of keyword tagging for people who use emoji in their tweets and then try and get some sort of contextual awareness out of this for advertisers.
Right.
And we all know that Twitter's been having a bit of a rough time getting advertising, let's whisper it, advertising revenue. Right. But do you reckon this could be something a bit different that might make a difference?
I mean, they haven't gone into any explicit detail about the future of sort of emoji advertising at the moment. I think from what I gather at the moment, it's still very simple. If someone does an emoji that's got a slice of pizza, they're probably going to be interested in pizza. Domino's will probably want to advertise with them.
Yeah.
But what it does potentially do is open the world up to artificial intelligence and machine learning. How often are you tweeting with with a pizza? Yeah.
So rather than the simple binary thing, because I actually think that I remember reading a quirky a little while ago where you could order pizza with emojis.
Yeah.
There's some kind of hard link between pizza and emojis going on here.
Do you know what they need to do? They need to tie in what we were talking about last week with Domino's one touch to order pizza with Twitter's
one emoji to order.
Emoji tracking.
I
so
they, I think they've looked into that
it,
already.
Yeah, it now knows when you're tweeting about pizza.
Back in Domino's sort of Willy Wonka-like lab,
yeah,
where they try and innovate on pizza, I think they've already looked into that.
Do you know what? I'd love us to do a podcast where we don't end on pizza. okay, right, a couple of other little things. IoT, definitely coming to life now. We have seen the Foldimate come into market in 2017. Exciting news, ladies and gentlemen. This is a clothes folding machine that, in every sense of the word, is putting things in order, I suppose. Yeah, I mean, sounds a bit fun, but I don't really fancy forking out $900 for it.
No, a bit of a first world problem, isn't it?
Just a tad, yeah. The advert was quite funny, though, you know, depressed-looking parents and an army of children just wreaking havoc with all the clothes while they're trying to fold up.
Well, we're getting back to that Terminator stuff, some sort of domestic bot that comes and sorts everything out. But when does it decide that it can make decisions better than you can?
Well, yeah, exactly. 1 in 3 millennials check their phone right after sex. Bit intimate, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, right after as well. Are we talking a second?
Well, I don't know, but it sounds like pillow talk is dead.
It does a bit.
And on that note, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to leave you to it. But you can now find A Week in Wireless on iTunes, Stitcher, and TuneIn, so you can subscribe and get the podcast directly onto your phone every week or into your browser as well. But yes, so that's it from A Week in Wireless today. I've been Tim Skinner. Say goodbye, Jamie Davies.
See you later.
And say goodbye, Scott Buccino.
Goodbye, Scott Buccino.
Oh, excellent. See you later, gang. Thanks very much for joining us. This has been A Week in Wireless, the podcast brought to you by telecoms.com, covering everything and anything in the telecoms industry. If you want to join the argument, tweet us at telecoms. Share your thoughts. We'll see you again next week. Same place, same time, same people, but even better.